podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by AOL Radio at AOL.com/podcasting. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson and Leo Laporte, episode 130 for February 7th, 2008. Listener feedback number 34. This show and the entire TWiT broadcast network is brought to you by donations from listeners like you. Thanks. It's time for Security Now, ladies and gentlemen, and I'm so glad to see Mr. Steve Gibson on the other side of the microphone. Hello, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be back with you once again. Episode 130. 130.
130. It's amazing. Separated only by the state of California. I'm in the north, you're in the south. So, yep. So actually, if I were to see you across the microphone, you'd be very dim and tiny.
Yeah, well, you would have an exceedingly good eyesight. Actually, I think the curvature of the Earth would completely preclude that.
I think you're right. You're a scientist at heart, and you can't get away with any of this fantasy stuff with you. None of that. Oh, I'm just finishing. Not finishing. I'm really in the middle of Night's Dawn Trilogy. Actually, you can't finish it. It's the world's longest book, but Night's Dawn Trilogy, Peter Hamilton, really great.
Oh, are you loving it?
Yeah. Well, it took a little while to get into it because there's so many storylines in it.
Yes.
And
yes.
They're very diverse storylines, so it took me a little while to kind of start piecing it together, but that's part of its charm, because once you do, I don't know how many pages in I am because the Kindle only gives you paragraph markings, but once you get a little far in on it, I'm three or four dots in.
And you probably have like 20 dots to go.
Oh, it's a big book.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
The Kindle always has the same number of dots. Have you noticed that?
Yes, although it is a proportional.
Right.
It is a proportional display.
Right.
So,
hey, there's some cool Kindle hacks. I think you mentioned this the other day, but did you know about the one that when you turn the radio on and then go to the Kindle browser, if you press Alt 1, it'll open up the Google Maps at your location?
No.
Yes.
Very cool.
It's because it's the cell. Well, it's at your location. It's the nearest cell site.
The only thing I really want is an on-screen clock.
Okay, that's one of the hacks.
Yay!
I'll look it up ahead. And I'll tell you before because I don't have it right in front of me. But there is a simple keystroke that will put a clock on the screen at the bottom of the menu.
Oh, no kidding!
Yeah.
So it's already built in there somewhere. It's just hidden.
Exactly. There are the Kindle actually had a surprisingly large number of undocumented. Keystrokes.
Well, it's impossible to ever surprise you about anything going on in the industry, but I had a note here to mention to you that Amazon is buying Audible.
Yeah. Yeah, that didn't surprise. I mean, that surprised me, but we've known about that for a little while. And actually, Audible is now a sponsor of this show as well. Happy to have them on board. They're on every show.
What show? You mean Security Now?
Security Now.
Oh,
they're,
no kidding.
They're on every show on the TWiT network. They're big. In fact, the day before the announcement, I got a very nice email saying how happy they were, how they looked forward to 2008 and a great relationship, and they were going to renew through the rest of the year. And then the next day, Amazon buys them. Now, I don't know if that's, how that's going to affect anything. So,
right.
But nevertheless, it was, a little bit of a surprise. So the guy you'd be interested in who hacked the Kindle, actually, I'd love to get Amazon as a sponsor. Goodness knows, Kindle should be advertising on this show.
Have you seen the count on my review on Amazon site?
How many?
It's like 11,000, I think. It's way more than twice the number two review.
Oh,
so,
wow.
Yeah.
Well, you'd like this Kindle hack. Because the guy who did it, and I'm still Googling around to try to find... Oh, it's Igorsk. The guy who did it, he got the ROM code, disassembled it, and figured it out.
Oh, beautiful. So pure reverse engineering.
Yeah. I mean, beautifully, beautifully done. It's just really remarkable. He starts by figuring out how to get root on it. And then he is able to download the code, disassemble it, and that's how he finds all these undocumented keyboard shortcuts. So let me find the time one. There's Minesweeper in it, by the way. Did you know that?
You know, I may have run across this article because I remember seeing...
You talked about it, I think.
And I remember seeing a whole list of goodies, but I did not... It didn't click with me that a clock was among them. So right, maybe there's a newer list.
So Alt... Okay, there's a couple. In the reader... At home, Alt-T shows the time. Do you have your Kindle in front of you?
No, I don't have it in front of me.
Because it's so very funny. Well, I won't tell you what happens. When you're reading, do an Alt-T. Oh, I'm going to tell you. It doesn't show the time digitally. It spells it out. It says like 6:30. Because you're reading.
Yep.
So I thought that was funny. Alt-T, that's what you need to remember.
So the people who did this clearly had some fun.
Igorsk. Igorsk did it. And
No, I mean the Amazon guys.
Oh,
who,
there's tons of stuff in there.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and it wasn't at Amazon. It was Lab 126. So if you go into settings and enter some numbers, you can see the Lab 126 team members if you enter 126. They clearly did. There's a lot of stuff in there that is kind of not documented. So anyway, I just thought I'd pass that along.
That's very cool.
Yeah. We have also Astaro back with us, so I'm going to do an Astaro commercial in a little bit. But do you have any addendum? Oh, and we should tell people this is a Q&A episode.
Yep, Q&A episode. I got all kinds of stuff. I did want to mention that Yahoo joins the ranks of being an OpenID authentication provider.
Yes. Isn't that great news?
Yep, so they're now supporting OpenID, which I hope will do a lot to promote OpenID. Unfortunately, they're only a single factor authenticator, so you know they're not competing with VeriSign's VIP. And in fact, it'd be very cool if they were to add that to VeriSign. So if we've got Yahoo members who would consider using Yahoo as an OpenID provider, you might drop Yahoo a little note through their support link and say, hey, how about adding VIP authentication? Because it's going to be, you know, even more secure that way,
of course,
as we all know.
If Microsoft buys them, then who knows?
Yeah, I was wondering about that, too. So
I mean, I'm actually a little disappointed. I hope that doesn't go through because I think... I like Yahoo, and I like their range of services, and I like their support for things like open source and OpenID. And, of course, all that would change if they were a Microsoft company.
Yeah, well, we've got, you know, Hungry Balmer is out scouting around trying to get them. So
yeah, he's trying to be Google is what he's trying
not.
To do.
Yeah.
Also, I have a couple of addenda when you're done,
yeah.
Just to let you know.
Okay, well, I did want to mention that I'm loving Jungle Disk. It just updated itself, or told me that there was one. It's up to 1.50C, and he's been fixing little things here and there. So, I mean, I got my bill from Amazon for last month, 10 cents.
I know, I got 3 cents.
And I have a ton of stuff up there, and I mean, I just love it, because I can, if there's something I absolutely want to have universal access to, like I'll drop some, I sent 120 megs up there, because I don't have my laptop with me,
right.
But when I do next, I want to be able to, you know, yank that thing down from Amazon. So it's just sort of, you know, it's data storage in the sky, and it's not very expensive.
And Jungle Disk makes it look, it's WebDAV, right? So it makes it look like a mounted disk.
Yes, under XP and Vista, that the WebDAV client is built in, so you're able just to map it to a drive. I'm still using Windows 2000. I did find a product that allows that essentially adds that feature to Windows 2000. Although there is the ability right now just to browse to that sort of like a folder where you don't have a drive mapping, and I find that's just as convenient as having it as a drive letter. But it wouldn't be, however, if I needed to, like, automate things like use, you know, my own backup solution rather than the one that's built into Jungle Disk in order to do that. So
because looking for a drive letter is so much easier. Every program can do that.
Well, I've got two really fun security event stories. This one's just going to boggle people's minds. You know, It's funny, years ago, many, many years ago, I remember refusing to talk to my attorney on my analog cell phone at the time because I knew that it wasn't secure. And that was probably I remember him thinking, come on, Steve. I said, no, I'm in the car right now. I'll call you back when I get to the office because this is a radio and you know, I'm not having a conversation with my attorney on, you know, on an analog cell phone. And so he's like, okay, fine, well, call me back.
And you were right, by the way. I've talked to many guys, many hackers, who just kind of made a habit of listening into analog cell phone recording.
You could have some fascinating things that you would overhear.
Yeah.
And so it's like, you know, radio, I mean, I know that listeners of Security Now know how skeptical I've always been about radio. Well, this story that was that just surfaced just really drives this home. This was posted on darkreading.com by Steve. I'm going to wreck his name, but I'm not. I'm sorry, Steve. I'm trying not to. It's Stasikonis something. Stasiakonis something. He's a VP and founder of Secure Network Technologies. They are a security penetration testing firm. Okay, now this is a true story, and it's got a serious theme to it, because there's one other area of wireless that is still, people are not thinking about it. Anyway, he says, in offices all over the world, users are becoming increasingly enamored with those wireless hands-free headsets that allow the speaker to move around the office while continuing a conversation on the phone.
You're not talking cell phone headsets. These are for landlines.
Exactly. So instead of having the coiled cord where you're having to stretch that around, you replace it with a little base station and wireless headset.
Right.
And he says, have you ever wondered how secure those headsets are? So have we. Recently, we had the chance to find out, and what we discovered was downright scary. If you don't know us, Secure Network Technologies is a penetration testing firm that focuses closely on the issues of physical security and social engineering. We were recently hired. Okay, so they were hired. So this what I'm about to describe here is legal. They were hired by a large organization to assess the company's network security and other potential vulnerabilities. Always anxious to try new things, we asked to test wireless signals leaving their building, including wireless access points, radio frequencies, etc., and potential vulnerabilities in those hot little hands-free headsets. To perform the work, we purchased a commercially available radio scanner. These devices are available at any local electronics retailer at prices ranging from $80 to several thousand dollars. We chose a scanner capable of monitoring frequencies from 900 to 928 megahertz and the 1.2 gigahertz ranges, which is where many of the popular hands-free headsets operate. We took a position across the street from the facility and started up the scanner. Within seconds of turning on the device, we were able to listen to conversations that appeared to be coming from our clients' employees.
Wow.
Several of these conversations discussed the business in detail, as well as very sensitive topics. After some careful listening, we determined that the conversations were indeed coming from our customer. After confirming that the sources of the conversations were on our clients' premises, we made note of the specific frequencies that were used and locked in on them. We could then record the conversations digitally using the scanner. Within minutes of this discovery, we contacted our customer and explained the vulnerability. We felt this issue could not wait for our final report. To demonstrate the sensitivity of what we discovered, we used the conversations we recorded to social engineer our way into the facility.
Oh, boy.
We gathered the names of people mentioned during conference calls, as well as other specifics about each person. We then singled out people that were foreign to the location we planned to enter. We singled out the names of people whom the callers had never met, people who had never been to the location, and people who were new to the organization.
Mm-hmm.
Our plan was to assume an identity of an employee who had never been to the office we were testing. Using that identity, we would enter the building, commandeer a place to sit and work, then see how long we could stay inside the building. After zeroing in on a particular employee, we gathered as much intelligence on him as we could. To prepare for the entry into the facility, we printed a business card with our assumed identity. I put on my best suit.
This guy likes his work way too much.
I put on my best suit, he says, and then went to work. When I entered the building, I was greeted by security. I indicated I was an employee and was in town to work. Yeah. I handed the security guard a business card and was welcomed with a smile. After escorting me to a cubicle, the guard showed me where the restroom was, where I could get a cup of coffee, and how to go about getting a building access card. After settling into my new workspace, I plugged my laptop into the network, started my network scanning tool, and retreated to the cafeteria for lunch. Upon my return, I was presented with a card access key to the building. The card was accompanied by a document outlining security policies regarding its usage. Clearly, the people who issued it never checked deeper into who I really was. With access card in hand, I started exploring the building.
Wow.
I had almost complete access. In the few places where the card did not work, such as the server room and fitness center, I used additional social engineering tactics to gain access to those as well. By day two, I was already accepted as an employee. In the morning, I was greeted by my would-be coworkers and security folks. I began to take some liberties, such as booking conference rooms, asking for refreshments, and gaining permission to bring in a vendor, unquote.
Wow.
Actually, Doug Shields, my partner here at Secure Network. In all, I spent 3 days inside the building, gaining access to numerous types of information, resources, and technology.
Oh, my goodness.
Our social engineering effort was just one exploit. The real danger is the information that was being emitted across the street from the company through the wireless headsets. This technology is convenient, but it is opening companies to potential calamity. With the data we heard, we could have made a stock play, provided valuable information to a competitor, or gone to the press with scandalous data. We also noted that when conversations ended, the headsets became bugging devices. Even after calls were terminated, we could hear headset wearers breathing, as well as any other conversations that were going on in their offices.
Oh, my goodness.
We were interested in this vulnerability, so we asked for permission for other clients to test it out at their locations as well. We ended up intercepting communications ranging from financial institutions, healthcare, and variety of other professions and industries. We heard conversations from administrators of computer networks, C-level, that is to say CEO, CIO, so forth, C-level executives, legal departments, and management teams. What did we prove? That many companies which fear security breaches and eavesdropping are actually bugging their own offices and spilling their private content over the open airwaves without their knowledge.
Unbelievable.
The problem is not unlike the early days of wireless LANs and Wi-Fi when the technology became popular before adequate security was developed. What can you do about it? The first step is to recognize the vulnerability. These headsets generally operate at 900 megahertz and, as we learned, are not necessarily secured with encryption. Find out who's using the technology and where. Secondly, you should consider doing a scanning test of your own, as we did for our client. It's worth $80 to make sure your corporate secrets are not unintentionally leaking out of the building via wireless headsets.
Now, just to make it clear, these wireless headsets aren't the same as, say, a cordless phone, or are they?
No, these are add-ons to typical corporate phones. Right. I mean, I've got one around here somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I have a Plantronics right here. I'm looking at it.
Yeah, it's very much like that. And this is exactly like me refusing to talk to my attorney on an early analog cell phone. I mean, arguably that was even worse because there you've got serious range. But these things work across the street. And, I mean, in this case, this guy, simply by overhearing conversations, was able to function as an employee in a company where he wasn't employed. The higher-ups knew and gave him permission to do this. But that permission was entirely optional.
Yeah.
I mean, anyone could do what this, you know, Steve and his partner, was it Doug or David, were able to do.
That's just amazing.
So I just wanted, I mean, this report, I just read this, I thought, okay, we've got to talk about this. I mean, just the idea that these little, they're basically handset extensions, and, you know, people who use them are bugging themselves.
Yeah, wow.
Okay, second amazing story of the week.
Okay.
This is also frightening. I mean, this is, what I'm about to read is horrifying and true. It was posted by a blog at Symantec describing an amazing Trojan known as Silent Banker. What's really fun about this, too, is that I'm going to read the blog entry. It touches on so many things that we have already talked about. So, I mean, this is a little bit of a walk in the park for our listeners. But the blog entry was titled Banking in Silence. Targeting over 400 banks, including my own, writes this blogger, this Symantec blogger, and having the ability to circumvent two-factor authentication are just two of the features that push the Silent Banker Trojan into the limelight. The scale and sophistication of this emerging banking Trojan is worrying, even for someone who sees banking Trojans on a daily basis. This Trojan downloads a configuration file that contains the domain names of over 400 banks. Not only are the usual large American banks targeted, but banks in many other countries are also targeting, including France, Spain, Ireland, the UK, Finland, Turkey, and the list goes on. The ability of this Trojan to perform man-in-the-middle attacks on valid transactions is what is most worrying. The Trojan can intercept transactions that require two-factor authentication. It can then silently change the user-entered destination bank account details to the attacker's account details instead. Of course, the Trojan ensures that the user does not notice this change by presenting the user with the details they expect to see while all the time sending the bank the attacker's details instead.
Oh, man.
Since the user doesn't notice anything wrong with the transaction, they will enter the second authentication password, in effect handing over their money to the attackers. The Trojan intercepts all of this traffic before it is encrypted, so even if the transaction takes place over SSL, and of course we know, we certainly hope it would, the attack is still valid. Unfortunately, we were unable to reproduce exactly such a transaction in the lab. However, through analysis of the Trojan's code, it can be seen that this feature is available to the attackers. The Trojan does not use this attack vector for all banks, however. It only uses this route when an easier route is not available. If a transaction can occur at the targeted bank using just a username and password, then the Trojan will take that information. If a certificate is also required, the Trojan can steal that too. If cookies are required, the Trojan steals those as well. In fact, even if the attacker is missing a piece of information to conduct a transaction, extra HTML is added to the page to ask the user for that additional information. And he shows two screenshots here. I've made a shortcut for this blog entry because it's really worth looking at it and for our listeners. It's just sniprl.com/SN130. That's the episode number of Security Now. So anyone can put sniprl.com/SN130, and they'll get this blog posting. He goes on to say, when instructed, the Trojan can also redirect users to an attacker-controlled server instead of the real bank, in order to perform a classic man-in-the-middle attack. Currently, there's only one bank targeted in this way. However, recent updates to the Trojan Oh, and get this. It gets constant updates using,
course.
You know, updated software. It says,
if it's working, then why not?
Yes.
Yeah.
Recent updates to the Trojan change the user's DNS settings, which we were talking about just recently a couple weeks ago. Change the user's DNS settings to point to an attacker-controlled DNS server. Using this technique, the Trojan can start redirecting any site to an attacker site at any time. This feature could also mean that if the Trojan is removed but the DNS settings are left unchanged, then the user will still be at risk. See below for the attacker's DNS server addresses. Add to all of the above the ability to steal FTP, POP, webmail, protected storage, and cached passwords, and then we start to see the capabilities of this Trojan. But it doesn't stop there. Don't forget the porn. The Trojan also contains over 600 pornographic website URLs that can be shown to the internet user so that the attacker can make money from the referrals. Lastly, the Trojan can also download updates, which it regularly does. It can also upload other executables and can use the infected image as a proxy or as a web server on any chosen port. In tests, the HTTP port used was 18102. The multiple configuration files that the Trojan downloads are updated several times per day, so it's more current than Windows is.
More current than anything.
Yeah.
More current than Norton antivirus.
And currently, the Trojan is capable of injecting HTML into about 200 different URLs, meaning that as a web page is being displayed by the user's browser, and this thing knows about both Internet Explorer and Firefox, as the web page is being displayed, the Trojan is able to intercept that communication and insert its own modifications, its own HTML, into the page. He says, the configuration files are compressed and encrypted. However, after decrypting them, we can see how the Trojan works in detail. And then he goes on into some additional detail, which many of our listeners may find interesting. Anyway, I mean, this is a beautiful posting because it gives you a sense for just how sophisticated Trojan technology is becoming. And, I mean, how much effort people are willing to go to for this kind of high-value attack.
Well, it also introduced to me a new category. I never heard the phrase banking Trojan, but obviously these are Trojans aimed at corrupting your internet banking experience, right?
Exactly. So you're right. There is now a classification of Trojans, a set of Trojans, of which this is perhaps, and this guy, from everything he's seen, is the most sophisticated one of all. And, for one reason, it's not like it's one Trojan for one particular bank, and so what's the chance that the infected user is going to...
400 banks.
Yes, and it's got specific scripting technology in order to deal with each one on a bank-by-bank basis.
So just to understand, it would get on your computer as an end user, and it would intercept information about your banking login, basically.
Correct. Essentially, you really don't want this Trojan on your machine if you're someone who does online banking.
And he mentions it's all over the world. I mean, it's not just U.S. banks. It's banks all over the world.
Right. Wow.
So something to be aware of. Banks, I think, routinely cover up these kinds of losses. But this is a loss to you. This wouldn't be a loss to the bank exactly.
Right. Well, yeah, exactly. You might very well go to check your balance and find that it has been zeroed because this thing watched you log in once.
Wow.
And, I mean, might right then have executed a funds transfer. If not, it knows how to, and it's able to send this back to headquarters, and then somebody else can log in as you. Even if, as this thing, I mean, this thing is so comprehensive that whatever authentication data is necessary, it understands, for example, you know, grabbing cookie details. So somebody could literally pretend to be you even if you had static cookies on your machine to identify you. And we, for example, we've talked about how authentication strength is reduced in instances where you do have a cookie because you've already authenticated your machine to the bank once before, and so it says, oh, well, this, you know, here's a cookie we recognize. We'll only ask for the username and password and not, you know, which kitten the guy, you know, has chosen in the past.
Right, right. Hey, I had a couple of emails I wanted to just to fill you in on. One is from, actually I got it from a number of people, but Remy was the first. He's a level designer at Ubisoft Montreal. Deep Freeze was the name of the program I was trying to remember. We were talking about Windows and Microsoft's capability of, what was the name of the Windows?
Steady State.
Steady State. So Deep Freeze is from Pharonix, and I've had a number of people recommend it to me in the past. Does something very similar, kind of resets the machine on every reboot.
Is it free?
No, it's not. And Microsoft's is.
Yep.
But Deep Freeze isn't hugely expensive. It depends on how many seats you have and so forth. It's $45 just for the basic
application.
So it's not hugely expensive, but if you had hundreds of seats, it would get more expensive. And then I want to thank Randall Schwartz and many other folks who are fans of TrueCrypt. The good news, you probably heard this also, there is now an OS X TrueCrypt. Right when we started talking about it, I went to the TrueCrypt site and said, we're working on a Mac beta. TrueCrypt 5 is out and, in fact, works on OS X. I've downloaded it. In fact, it is compatible across OS X, Windows, and Linux. So you can have a TrueCrypt encrypted file, folder, or disk, and you could read it on any of those three operating systems.
Very cool.
Yeah.
And in fact, there was so much interest in this that our Q&A that we'll be getting to shortly talks about some things that are built in already to the Mac.
Oh, yes, of course. And now it's time. Are you ready?
I'm ready, Leo.
You feel good? It's time. It's question time. And we'll start off with Lynn in Kalamazoo. Lynn has a lot to say. Hello, Steve and Leo, longtime listener here. Start off with you on show one. Shouldn't that have been show zero? Yes, in true programmer's form, I should have named it zero. Twit started with zero. But I don't know why. I wasn't thinking. We started with show one. Love the show. Frequently re-listen to past episodes to keep your ideas and teaching fresh in my mind. We do recommend that.
I don't
gain anything from that, but I think there is an advantage to that. You know, listen again and again. I don't gain anything from it, Steve. We all, you know, it's I like that idea. I have to listen to it again. I get something more every time. I'm on the road about 3 hours a day, so I get a lot of security now, and I love it. Additionally, about 6 months ago, I became a SpinRite customer. I have 11 computers, 30 hard drives at home. What? Like most of your other listeners, I've saved several drives and many gigabytes of information with SpinRite. I don't know how I live without it. Your last episode reminded me that I, too, had a few old broken dead drives in storage. Remember, we were talking about that. You know, it's somebody had resurrected a drive. They hadn't used it. Well, they'd wrapped it up and hadn't used it in years.
Yeah.
So it was kind of like cutting off your head and hoping that and freezing it. Someday they'll be able to resurrect you. So I was able to revive them and get some cool data I've missed over the years. You know, I have to do that. I have tons of drives. Everybody does. Just, you know, old 20 megabyte drives, things like that. It would work with any drive, right?
Sure, any IDE drive. And I mean, even pre-IDE, if you still have the controller lying around.
MFM, RLL, remember those?
Yep.
Your last episode, oh yeah, okay, my longest drive recovery, oh, get this. Now, our record is 3 months, I think, right?
I think so.
He took 17 days. That means his SpinRite was running for 17 days, but he's patient. He'd heard about 3 months, I guess. My SpinRite finally sorted everything out. I was able to get what I needed back from the drive. One question, though, about SpinRite. I have an expensive Aviation Garmin GPS unit that's having a memory issue. It has 512 megs of RAM. It treats as a drive. I can't get DOS to see it as a drive, or I can get DOS to see it as a drive. If I plug it in via USB, can I get SpinRite to work on it? I'm a pilot, and I really depend on my GPS. I'd love to save the $2,000 from buying another one. Those are vital, you know, those GPSs. Problem is USB, right?
Well, I don't know exactly. He says he has a RAM issue. I would advise him not to use SpinRite on that system, because you really don't want to run SpinRite on non-volatile RAM. All it will do is tend to, you know, bring it closer to its end of life. So I would never recommend running SpinRite on any kind of non-volatile solid-state storage. We've talked about how ultimately all it does is move them further toward end of life. So it's really not what you want to do. I don't know enough about his system. What kind of an issue, as he puts it, he has. I mean, if DOS will see it, SpinRite will run on it.
So it's a USB drive, though.
Oh, yeah, if absolutely.
Oh, it will?
Yeah.
I thought the USB interface hid drive essentials that you needed to see.
No, you can still read and write, and SpinRite's able to back itself off and use as much of the available interface as possible.
So you won't get the low-level stuff.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. You don't have the ability to talk as intimately to the drive as when you plug it onto the motherboard directly, but it still works and it still does data recovery.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought we had to connect via IDE. Oh, that's good to know. That's good to know. So worth at least trying.
So, yeah, I would, I mean,
if it's really RAM, if it's flash, don't do it.
If it's flash, don't do it.
It has to be non-volatile, otherwise it'd be useless.
Yeah. See, I don't understand what data he's got there. I would say
apps.
Pull it all off and just reformat it. I would think maybe just reformatting it ought to, cure whatever problem he's got.
There you go. He has more. He says, now on to my questions regarding enterprise and corporate security. First, is Sprint's wireless data card safe? I use a Verizon EVDO card, like the Sprint one. He says, am I beyond? So I'm curious about this answer, too. Am I behind an app router? Do I need a software firewall? I've been running the Sprint card for about a year with no issues, but I was wondering what my exposure is. It's corporate laptop sensitive data. I thought we should know. I haven't heard about this on Security Now yet. It fails the Shields Up All Stealth test. It has a service ports green, except for port 22, which is closed. So I fail Shields Up, but everything is blocked. As far as 22 is SSH, right?
Yeah.
As far as a router, my traceroute hops 7 times in the 68... range before going to wired LAN network. So there's 7 hops within the Sprint network. Is there anything wireless data card users should do to stay secure? How do these differ from my home network protected by my NAT router? Second, should we answer that first before we go on to a spreadsheet?
Yeah. Okay. Now, I don't want to freak everyone out.
Oh, boy.
But both...
I'm freaked out already.
Both types of cellular technology, both GSM and CDMA, unfortunately use encryption that was, I can just hear our listeners getting ready for this, was designed by engineers and not by crypto people.
Just like WEP.
In their defense, in defense of the cell technology, back when this was first done, it was much more expensive to have processing power than it is now.
Right.
The at least in the case of GSM, it's based on a shift register. I think it's 3 different shift registers with multiple taps, which is one way of generating pseudo-random data. They've tried, the people doing it tried to keep this as a trade secret, tried to keep it proprietary. Bottom line is, it's been cracked.
You understand, first of all, this is CDMA, and it's EVDO, it's EVDO, it's Sprint.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Now, exactly. Now, but CDMA has been cracked also.
Oh.
So.
And I don't know if EVDO really uses CDMA technology. It's on those frequencies, but it might use something else.
Actually, it does. All EVDO is really doing is aggregating a bunch of channels together, and essentially that's where you get all this extra bandwidth.
Oh, interesting.
It just pulls a bunch of cell channels together and uses them all in parallel in order to increase its speed.
Oh, interesting.
I don't know one way or another for sure whether there's an additional layer of encryption on top of the standard cell technology. And when I started saying I don't want to freak out our listeners, it's not like CDMA and GPRS or GSM has been cracked to the degree, for example, that Wi-Fi has been. But there are papers on the net that talk about, how this stuff can be cracked. So it's not like there's super strong industrial grade, current state-of-the-art crypto. The problem is these technologies, these digital cellular technologies are so old and now so widely deployed that they can't be updated without obsoleting the entire network. And, they're encrypted to the extent that you have to really, really, really want to crack them in order to get inside them, but it is possible, has been done.
I'm reading here that EVDO uses a 42-bit pseudo noise sequence called a long code to scramble the transmissions.
Right. I mean,
that's not very long.
No, it's not. And again,
And then it uses AES.
On top of it.
Yeah. Well, wait a minute. Now, wait a minute. The long code scrambles transmissions through the standardized cellular authentication and voice encryption algorithm, which is probably the one that's broken, to generate a 128-bit subkey called shared secret data, SSD. This key feeds into an AES algorithm to encrypt transmissions.
Well, that does sound pretty good.
If it's using AES with a 128-bit key generated by random pseudo noise.
Yeah, it doesn't sound like it's using any kind of a public key technology, and I don't know where the shared secret comes from. It might be based on the phone number, or maybe it's established ahead of time. Anyway, it is on my list of things to research deeply, so I can, you know, we'll spend an hour here before too long talking in detail about cellular encryption technology, because I know lots of people are, you know, a little anxious about it.
Well, the thing that makes me anxious is maybe EVDO is secure, the data is secure, but it sounds like voice transmissions over GSM and CDMA are not.
Right. They would be relying on that initial level of obfuscation,
right,
which you really cannot consider as being encryption.
Right. You know, it's funny, because when we went from analog to digital cell phones, I remember, you know, because as we talked about earlier, analog cell phones, just like analog landlines, were worth, you know, completely monitorable.
Yep.
And I remember asking hackers, and they said, well, we don't know how, but... Probably you could hack into it.
Probably
you could. We just, and this was very early on. He has another question. This is you're right. He has a lot to say. But Lynn, we don't mind, because you're a pilot and you're going to fly us safe the next time we go up in the air. I've never heard the question on Security Now about Microsoft Excel security. Okay. I often timeshare Excel spreadsheets with people who I want to be able to use the spreadsheet but not see my formulas or change anything. As most folks know, if you use sheet protection and a complicated 64-bit password, it can be easily cracked in seconds with freeware out there. Okay. My question would be, is there any way to secure Excel so that it cannot be cracked and you can keep formulas and data from being changed? I did try to use OpenOffice's XML formatting with protection, but then, of course, Microsoft Windows customers or Office customers can't use them. Steve and Leo, please help.
Yeah, this was an interesting question. I mean, he obviously knows that the built-in password protection that's afforded to Excel, you know, there's lots of freeware around there that'll crack that easily. The only thing I could suggest, I don't quite understand what he's hoping to achieve. He wants to allow people to view his spreadsheet but not change it. So the thought that I had was to print it to a PDF file, and then they've got the spreadsheet data, contents, charts, and all that stuff in a non-modifiable form, which is apparently what he wants them to see but not be able to change. So, you know, that was the one thought that I had. Other than that, I mean, you could use external encryption to encrypt the file very strongly, but then you'd have to give anyone the password in order to decrypt it if they wanted to display it. So I don't think that really solves his problem. The only thing I could think was just move it out of an Excel format into a printed form and you know, share it that way.
Yeah, it depends how he wants people to use it. If he wants them to be able to enter their own numbers,
yeah,
then I think you're out of luck. I think you have to use whatever Microsoft does, and clearly Microsoft's not doing much.
Right.
Chuck in Tennessee suffers from debris. Hey, you wrote a little poem there. How do you deal with all the pre-installed junk when you buy a new machine? I've thought of just buying a new copy of Windows to go with every new machine. That gets expensive. Have you purchased Windows off the shelf just to get as clean a slate as possible? Is this obsessive? Also, are there a range of running processes that you'd like Task Manager to be showing?
Now, this is a great question that comes up, you know, often, and I was sort of talking about it the other day. I was very impressed, frankly, with how clean the most recent two Dell systems that I've seen, a laptop and a desktop. They both had virtually nothing on them that I was unhappy with. I also recently purchased some ThinkPads for my employees, and unfortunately there was a bunch of junk there, and I've seen other machines which I mean are just oh my god, HP's current offerings.
HP's the worst. There's nobody worse.
I've taken exactly the the position that Chuck has, which is the only way to deal with this is just to scrape off the machine and start over. Now, I'm a paid MSDN developer, so I have the right to install, for example, XP.
You pay them. They don't pay you.
Oh, yeah. I pay them $2,500.
He pays a lot.
$2,700 or something.
But you get
a
licensed copy of Windows that you can install on as many machines as you want.
Yeah,
it's no big deal for you.
I can't give it away, of course.
No.
But so that's not a problem for me. My point is that both with the recent ThinkPad and with the recent HP, even armed with all the drivers that I can find on their sites, I have been unable to install a clean build of a clean install of Windows and get rid of all the little yellow exclamation points under the device manager to make it happy again. On little HP Pavilion, I was never able to get the CD DVD ROM working on my, and I tried the same thing on my ThinkPad. I spent 2 days trying to start from scratch, install Windows. Of course, I'm using Drive Snapshot all the time in order to make, you know, checkpoints. And I should say, of course, that before I did anything, I made a snapshot of before I even booted it the first time, I made a snapshot of it. So that if my attempt to install clean and build it up failed, then I could get back to the way it was when it first got taken out of the box. What I ended up doing with the ThinkPad on all four of them now is simply removing stuff. I don't like using add remove programs in order to remove the annoying stuff, but there really was no choice. And I always sort of feel like, well, there's going to be some debris left. It's not really, is it really removed completely? We've had no trouble with our ThinkPads where we just started with the way it came and then backed out of that back to leaving the things installed that are necessary. And in most recent cases, I've been unsuccessful unfortunately, in installing a clean version of Windows and then getting all the various, basically just the device drivers and additional stuff that I wanted to have there working. So, you know, it's a mixed blessing. I would just say don't buy HP, buy Dell.
There are a couple of things to say about that.
They've got to get a clue about this, Leo. It is so bad.
Well, Dell used to, and I think one of the reasons they don't, they have this program where they ask users what they want to change, and they've done a number of things. That's why they brought back XP. That's why they offer Linux, and it's why Dell, which is, I think, has done a very good job of removing the junk. There is a program. Actually, was a guy wrote it because he was so frustrated with his HP, called the PC Decrapifier.
Yes, I've heard of that,
yeah,
too.
It's PCDecrapifier.com. It's free. And it does other things. I mean, it's one thing to uninstall stuff, but it also does things like resets the home and search pages, eliminates unnecessary startup items. You know, it takes out things like Google and Yahoo toolbar. So there's a lot of stuff that I think is, this is a choice. The other thing is many manufacturers, some will still sell you a real Windows disk as opposed to a recovery disk. The recovery disk, of course, recovers the crap. But a real Windows disk, with a hologram on it and all that, is just a Windows disk. So if it comes with that, then you're golden.
I should mention, speaking of installing Windows, that I was poking around Microsoft's MSDN site just the other day, and I noticed with glee that Service Pack 3 for Windows XP is now at release candidate 1 state.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, please.
Hallelujah.
No more 95 or 98 updates and rebooting 9 times for the updates.
Well,
to get
not for a few
updated.
Months, and then you'll have to do that again.
Yeah, that's true.
And by the way, we should mention that the Vista SP1 has now been released. It's not. It won't be up. You won't be pushed out to you till March, probably.
Who cares?
Some people care. And we'll talk about it. Paul Thurrott and I will, I'm sure, talk about it Friday on Weekly, as well as SP3 for XP. Because that's finally out, which is nice. I mean, I don't know if it makes Vista better, but anyway, it's out.
Yeah.
So, thank you. That was a good question.
He did also ask about Task Manager, and there's no easy way to answer the question about running processes. But
I can tell you a place to go.
I will say that every so often I will look at, for example, the processes running on GRC's Win2K box, and I'm just jarred by how few there are.
Compared
because
to
when
XP,
I, when I,
yeah.
When I set it up, I went through and I turned off all this nonsense, especially for a server that's just going to sit there.
Right,
you know, it's
right.
not doesn't need all kinds of wacky stuff running. And, you know, sometimes I'll turn things off that I later need. Like I'll turn off the DHCP client because I'm not using dynamic IPs within my own network. I'm in a 10-dot network and I sign them all myself. And then I'll take a machine somewhere and it won't connect. I was like, what the heck? It's like, oh, wait a minute. I turned off the DHCP. But again, it's like I bolt these machines down and reduce the running processes. You know, just as a matter of best practices in security, and it boots a lot faster, too.
Black Viper, who did this most famously for XP and then went offline, is back. He's back. BlackViper.com, BlackViper.com. And he does have all of the configuration recommendations and the services you can turn off, and at least explains what they do.
Isn't it so annoying, too, that Microsoft gives you this one little line? It's like, you know, tracks changes to multiple files over the network. It's like, okay, well, do I need that or not?
Right. And that's what Black Viper was a gamer, but he's by trial and error, went through all these services to figure out what you could turn off and what you had to leave on. So that's a good source of stuff you could turn off. And then, of course, you can use MSConfig, but I recommend Auto Runs. That's Mark Rusinovich's program now from Microsoft.
Yep.
At SysInternals, it's Microsoft. Just Google Auto Runs and Microsoft, you'll find it. A listener who didn't leave his name wonders about the dark side. Maybe he wants to be anonymous. Hi, Steve and Leo. Thanks for such a great show. I've learned a lot. You guys have never really talked about cracks, pirated software, the whole wares scene. I knew a guy used to call it Juarez, W-A-R-E-Z, wares scene. It surprises me how many people use serials and cracks. Without considering the security implications, I don't pirate software at all for lots of reasons. Many people do. Well, boy, I'll tell you one thing. Those wares sites are a hotbed
of
security exploits.
It's true confession time. Not long ago, maybe about 2 months ago, I was really annoyed with my copy of Eudora, which was, you know, in standard form several versions back. Because it had not been giving me a problem, but I was, and I mean, I know I love Eudora. I've been using it forever. I actually own many more registrations because I used to have employees that were all registered Eudora users, and so I mean, they wandered off and no longer using Eudora, and so I thought, okay, well, and I was having a problem because one of the cool things Eudora does is it stores all of the contents of a folder in a single text file. Which is just nice. The problem is it tries to parse that file by just scanning the headers, and sometimes it gets messed up, especially if people are including what looks like email inside of email. Then that really gives it heartburn. So I thought, okay, I wonder if they've like fixed this with newer Eudora. So I went to Eudora.com. and, you know, immediately was greeted with, "We're sorry, we're no longer publishing Eudora. Version 7.1 was the last one. You can't have it." I think the sponsored edition, which gives you ads in the UI that you could still have. And then they say, "Oh, but don't worry, it's going to be going open source and it'll be coming out soon." Well, so I investigated that. It turns out that that's really not true. Instead, the Mozilla people are putting a Eudora UI onto their email client, their communications client. So it's like, okay, well, that's not what I want. So I thought, okay, what am I going to do? I mean, I own a whole ton of these licenses. I can't get a 7.1. I'd be happy to purchase it if I could, but they don't sell anymore. So into the wares sites. Knowing the danger of this, I used what I consider a sacrificial computer because, as you said, Leo, it is beyond bad. And I did manage to get this machine deeply, horribly infected just by trying to poke around and see whether I could find something that would allow me to generate, you know, a key for a copy of Eudora that I was hoping would work, which, again, I would have been glad to pay for. And in fact, I've paid for it many, many more times than I'm using it now. So I think, okay, you know, morally, I'm ethically, yeah. I'm in yeah. the clear. But anyway, you know, that's essentially how I feel about this. Is you know, again, you want to do what you feel is the right thing. There are solutions out there, but boy, as you said, Leo, they will. I mean, nothing will hose your system faster than poking around in those dark corners.
Well, just think about it. I mean, if you run a Wares or a Cracks site, actually, no, let me put it the other way. Let's say you're one of those people who wants to get exploits, Trojan horses, viruses, spyware on other people's machines. You bought one of those kits from the Russian website. You just need a website to put all that malware on. Now, what are you going to put together for a website? Well, you're either going to do porn or you're going to do Cracks and Wares. That's right. Going to draw people in. Or serial number sites. And so, of course, that's where all of these exploits are sitting. Now, we used, you know, occasionally on the screensavers, we would urgently need to run a program, and we would, I'm ashamed to admit it, figuring that, well, the company would want us to show the program on TV, we would go and get a serial number for that program.
Sure.
But I haven't done that in years. I wouldn't dream of doing it, first of all, because I want to buy my software, but also because that's a sure way to get infected.
Yep.
You know, I mean, do it if you're gonna do something like that, do it on a VMware version of Windows that you then erase.
Well, and that machine was seriously compromised. It had, I mean, little command dialog boxes were popping up, and then it was installing servers, and I mean, it was really amazing. I thought, well, I'm sure glad I didn't just go browsing around these horrible places with my AIM machine, or it would be start over time.
No kidding.
Yep.
Yikes. Aaron Skinner in Omaha, Nebraska. He's considering going steady. So here's my scenario. I'm running Windows XP Media Center Edition 2005. I have a couple of roommates who also use my computer. This computer is also used to play some online games. By the way, games like Battlefield 2142 don't seem to run right unless you install and run from an administrator account. Yeah, that's true. I'd like to have a setup with my personal login, another login for my roommates and gaming. I want my personal login to have full access to everything, and the roommate gaming to reset after log-off. Well, I think we know the answer to this, so no changes are saved, although this may cause issues with game save data. In addition, I still want my media center to fully function, you know, record TV shows, even if I'm not logged in or I'm the only one who can do it. I'm also using Avast, which is an antivirus, home version. I want to be sure it gets automatic updates. Basically, I want to limit the roommates from doing damage to my computer while leaving my computer and gaming experience unhindered, continuing to run as admin, I guess. I'm interested if and how steady state can be used in my situation. Oh, he heard the steady state episode.
Yeah, and so he was wondering if it would apply to him. The only problem that I could see is, first of all, Avast, as I recall, was not one of the few AV systems that steady state was aware of. There were several, unfortunately, like, I mean, McAfee was one, and I don't remember now what they were, but there were only a couple that steady state could deliberately interact with, and it certainly does require deliberate interaction and operation in order to deliberately bypass this whole drive prophylactic, essentially, that steady state wraps your system partition in, your C drive. So I don't think that steady state would work for Avast, as I recall, and that's a problem. The other problem is that doing something like saving, recording TV shows, you do have this driver sitting there which is journaling changes to the system. And for example, when the admin, when God of that machine logs off, you get a dialogue that says, do you want to retain the changes? Do you want to flush the changes? So then you decide what you want to do with what has happened while you as the administrator were logged on. Non-admin users, that is to say, anyone who's not that main administrator account doesn't have the choice, of course. They would be like the user in the library that flushes their changes off the moment they log off. But that does imply that this Windows journaling thing is going along and is on all the time. So it feels to me like this is probably not the best solution in this case. I would say, you know, setting up some sort of a virtual machine for the other people to use, which, you know, give them containment that makes more sense in this environment. Because the steady state is certainly designed in a shared access mode, but doesn't, I think Aaron's application is pushing it a little too far, and I don't think he'd be happy with the way it works.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess Deep Freeze would probably have exactly the same issues. I mean, anything would that's going to try to maintain that state.
Yep.
Amir Katz, listening to us from Kfar Saba, Israel. Hello, Amir. Needs just a little encryption, just a little tiny bit of encryption. Hi, Steve. You've dedicated a full Security Now episode to TrueCrypt. You've mentioned it a few times afterwards, and again today. However, I find I don't need to encrypt a whole partition or even a whole folder, just a few files. An AXCrypt, AXCrypt, is a simple and effective tool for just such tasks, especially if I don't need on-the-fly encryption. It's open source, GPL license, also has a secure delete feature, like S-Delete, which we mentioned a couple of episodes ago. Can you comment on its security? I find it extremely easy to use. I'm a loyal Security Now listener from episode one and a proud SpinRite user.
Well, it's funny. I had to go back and check to see whether I had ever referred to AXCrypt in earlier episodes, and I haven't, because it's what I use.
You're kidding. Funny.
Yeah, I mean, I discovered it maybe a couple months ago when I was specifically looking around for and it's also free, by the way. It's voluntary support through PayPal and Amazon and a few other things. It is a tremendous little program. It is very lightweight. It is different than I answered a question like this maybe a few weeks ago, and it was a different program. I'm trying to think of the name now, because it was for a slightly different application. And I'm looking here, and OMZIFF, OMZIFF. That was the encryption tool I recommended specifically because it made no modifications to the system it was run on. It was a completely freestanding executable. By comparison, AXCrypt does integrate itself into Windows, so it's more of an installation. It's not quite as standalone. And, for example, it adds right-click context menu support. So, for example, you could right-click on a file and say, encrypt yourself to the file. So it's a little heavier duty, but I like it very much. And I've been very impressed with it and the way it operates. And now I'm worried I'm going to get AXCrypt and OMZIFF confused. But I think AXCrypt is the one which can make a self-decompressing EXE, which is also very cool.
Oh, that's very handy, because you can send it to somebody.
Yes, and yeah. So exactly. So you turn it in, you turn an archive of files, for example, into an EXE, where when you run it, it prompts you for the file name, and it's all AES 256-bit. I mean, it's really, really good security. And as he says, it's open source, GPL'd, and you can even download the source from the AXCrypt site. So I absolutely do recommend it. It's a beautiful little program. I like it a lot.
Good. Well, thank you, Amir. Good suggestion. Another anonymous listener has a question about IP space. Hi, Steve. I work at a large university which owns a Class B public IP range, for example, 65.92.0.1 to 65.92.255.255. That's not the range, but that's an example. Consisting of 60,000 plus possible internet addresses, if my math's right. I've never been able to get info on how much this costs the university, although I know from my work in the private sector that a single IP can easily cost $5 a month. I don't think you multiply it by 60,000, but maybe I'm wrong. Whether the IPs are subsidized or not, it seems like a huge waste of money. Somebody must be paying somewhere, and an unnecessary exposure to script kiddies and hackers, when over 90% of our users would be equally served with a free private IP range. In other words, having maybe one address for the whole university, which you use DHCP to share out.
Yep.
Do other universities do this? Are they all subsidized? And if so, are taxpayers picking up millions of dollars in billing for what seems to be nothing more than an increased security risk? I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, particularly if I'm totally wrong. It's not just universities. I mean, internet service providers, lots of people buy big blocks.
Well,
B class is big.
He's totally wrong.
Oh.
IPs don't cost anything.
Oh.
Unless
you're reselling them. Yeah.
Exactly. So you know, we've never talked about this, so I thought it was a really great question. Back in the beginning, we had 32 bits of IP space. And it didn't used to be that networks could be divided sort of on arbitrary bit boundaries. We have talked about this notion of class A, class B, and class C networks. A C class network having 1 byte of IP addressing, that is to say 256 addresses, but you only get, you lose a couple from that network. That's a class C. A class B had 2 bytes of addressing, which is what this listener is talking about here, where then you're going to have 64K possible IP addresses within that network. And then, of course, a class A, you have 3 bytes of addressing.
Right.
So that's 24 bits of address space. So what happened was that the original 32-bit address space was just sort of chopped up in big pieces. There are some universities, and universities were, of course, part of the early adopters of the internet. And so this, you know, this guy works for a large university. They just got themselves a B-class network. So they've got, you know, as he says, they have 2 bytes of addressing with the first 2 bytes are fixed for, which essentially is the address of their big B-class network. And he's very right that it may well be that the university does not need 65536 or, you know, less a few individual IP addresses. But they've got them, and they're not going to let them go.
So they were given them at the beginning.
Yes.
As an EDU or whatever.
Yes. And, for example, you know, level 3, I think, has all of 4 dot. And BBN was one of the other early adopters.
Well, they invented the internet. They could probably have anything they wanted.
I think they've got like 1 dot or 2 dot
yeah,
or something.
That
I
would
mean,
make
they're,
sense.
So essentially the idea is that all of these, the really main tier one ISPs generally own a huge chunk of IP space. I'm embarrassed to say that I at home have 64 IPs, of which I use 1 because I'm behind a NAT router.
And you get that because you bought servers service or something, right?
No. It's funky because this actually was due to my great relationship in the old days with Vario, where I did need some space, and I had 232 IP blocks that were disjoint. And so when I switched over, when Vario sold the T1's business over to Cogent, you know, they took Vario's engineers, who I knew really well, you know, and Andy, my old Vario engineer, said, "Well, so how many do you want?" And I said, "Well, Andy, I really don't need any." "Oh, come on, take as many as you need." And whereas, for example, with Level 3, who is now hosting GRC's bandwidth, they were like, "Prove to us you need more than 2.
Right.
I said, "Well, what do you mean? No, prove you." No. So I had to literally fill out a sheet showing how and why, and they called it the IP justification form.
Oh, my goodness.
I had to fill out a form because they're not wanting anyone to waste them because they're their precious resource.
Right.
And nobody who ever gets any IP
ever gives them back. Yeah.
Ever gives them back.
Mine. Not exactly. Now I understand.
So
well,
it really is
interesting.
You know, it's a weird sort of bizarre consequence of the early days of the internet when, you know, people would say, okay, how many class B's do you need? They just chop them up and, you know, because they weren't valuable then. Now they're the most precious resource on the planet.
Well, now I figure we're done, right? Everybody's got something and there's nothing left. I mean,
do you know that there's still only about 60% of the IP space is in use?
Wow.
40% is still just slack. It's people like the university hoarding the IP space because they don't want to give it back, even though they may not be using it. And somebody else could. It's like, no. This is ours. This is our Class B.
Well, it makes it easier for the record companies because they say, oh, there's 6592. We know where that is. Why, yep. That's U of A or whatever it is.
That's very true. And, of course, after you've been doing networking long enough,
you start recognizing those, yeah.
Yes, you can just see the IPs and go, oh, this is, Cox Cable, this is Comcast, this is Roadrunner, blah, blah, blah. Oh, this is an AOL block,
Well, when you said 4.0, I said, well, that's Verizon. So, obviously, level one has given some to Verizon.
Exactly.
Yeah. Brian Bienhoff has a Mac file security. Well, he has Mac file security pretty well nailed. I've been listening to Security Now since episode one. Again, another great listener from the actual time it was released. Not by archive diving. I've been listening since day one, he says. In the most recent listener feedback episode, 128, you had a question about encrypting files and folders on a Mac without using File Vault. Oh, I got a number of people sending me this.
Oh, Leo, half of the email that I've received recently were Mac people who were proud. So I wanted to acknowledge everybody wrote in.
Yes. Yeah, and actually, I mean, I should have mentioned it. I've used this technique for years. In Disk Utility, you can create an encrypted disk image. It's a .dmg file that requires a password to mount. This obviously doesn't encrypt the whole home directory, but if you want to keep a set of files or folders encrypted, it can do the trick. You can even save the image's password in your account's encrypted keychain, put the file in your login items so it automatically gets mounted whenever you log in. You don't even have to enter a password, although you might not want to do that if you want more security. Another question mentioned erasing files securely on the Mac. In addition to secure empty trash, which according to Apple completely overwrites files with meaningless data, and I will vouch for that because it takes about 20 times longer to empty the trash when you use it. You can also securely clear all the free space in a hard drive. Disk Utility to the rescue again. Select the drive, go to the Erase tab. Oh, that's right. I have seen this setting. Then you can erase free space with a 7-pass or 35-pass overwrite. Finally, if you boot to the OS X installation disk, you can run Disk Utility from the menu bar and securely erase the whole hard drive with 7 or 35-pass secure deletion, no DBAN needed. So Apple obviously gives you a number of ways to get this done.
Yep, and Brad pretty much covered the bases. Again, I wanted to acknowledge everybody who wrote in with various flavors and pieces of that. I mean, from what he said, and being a person who doesn't want to install software I don't need, I love the idea that you can create essentially an encrypted partition, one of these DMG files,
right,
and and put things in there, knowing that if you remove the password from it, it's really going to be safe. Also, remember that if you delete files from there, you're not leaving them sitting there in the clear on your drive, because Apple is encrypting them on the way to the drive, so they're always encrypted. So you essentially have sort of the equivalent of secure delete for free.
Right. Yeah, this is a really good technique. Also, you can make a sparse encrypted image, so it's small, but it can expand to accommodate whatever files you put in it. And when you mount it, it mounts like there's a drive there. So it just shows up as another drive. So it's actually a very good technique.
Nice.
Steve Hedry of Kitchener, Ontario, says, Steve missed an obvious solution. Maybe. Hi, folks. I've been an insatiable listener from the beginning, another number one listener. You're all number ones. Steve's knowledge never ceases to amaze me. I hope the show never stops. One thing that surprised me, though, is his solution to the recurring question of how to provide both WEP and WPA access without risking compromise of the WPA side from the WEP access point. Steve has repeatedly described what seems to be kind of a kludgy solution involving three routers. Why doesn't he recommend using one of the free Linux firewall solutions, IPCOP, Endian Firewall, Smoothwall, that allows separate networks to share an internet connection without the untrusted network being able to see the trusted one? Both of these forks of the original Smoothwall install into an old PC with multiple NICs. You do need two NICs. I guess you might need three in this case. And allow up to three isolated networks with each less trusted network being unable to see the more trusted network. They are full-featured firewall routers in their own right as well, and great use for an old Pentium 2 or 3. I might also add you could use a Starro Security Gateway for this. That's Leo talking. Endian is available as a hardware appliance as well as a free distribution for PC. Setting up one of these seems to be a lot more straightforward and elegant than rigging multiple routers together for the same purpose. Am I missing something? Keep up the good work. Love the show. Wouldn't be without SpinRite either.
Well, he's absolutely right. I don't think this was an obvious solution, but I'm certainly aware of it. I guess the issue is for a high-end user, for somebody who has a PC, can install multiple NICs, wants to go into a Unix-based solution, absolutely this makes sense. Except that then you still need your wireless radios. So presumably you'd have a WPA router and a WEP router still. So really, I don't think you've solved any problems.
Because the router's doing essentially the same thing as a security gateway. So you've used up a computer. The router is a $40 way to do this, I guess.
Yes, exactly. And so the reason I like the what I'll call the plastic consumer box approach of just taking three routers and plugging them in a Y connection is that solves the problem. And this replaces the internet-facing router, which splits the connection to a WPA and a WEP router, but you needed one anyway. So I didn't mean to snub all of these really nice turnkey solutions. And, of course, Astaro is, as you mentioned, Leo, is one as well. But you would still need two more routers, one for each of the Wi-Fi formats. So you haven't really made anything simpler, it seems to me, although you've got a lot more configuration power, although a lot more configuration responsibility as well.
It's very powerful. You can do a lot more with that.
Yeah.
You still have the triangle. I mean, the concept is basically the same. It's just using a different appliance to do it.
Yes.
Joe in Sacramento has, California, some additional clarification about built-in Mac encryption. And enterprise security question. On the last listener feedback show, Leo was asked if he knew of anything that would encrypt a folder on the Mac. You can use Disk Utility to create a new disk image with a 256-bit AES password encrypted encryption. You specify the image size like 2 gigs. It creates a file of that size that's encrypted, which you can then open and write files to and close when you're done. Best of all, it's part of OS X. Well, and I should say the sparse image is probably more economical. It grows to accommodate what you need.
Yeah, I love that. I love that solution.
Yeah. That's what I use, is encrypted sparse image DMGs, and it's very useful. I actually keep a bunch of notes in those things with serial numbers and stuff, and I keep it completely. I feel secure. Another note about enterprise security at my work: they've implemented full disk encryption using Checkpoint. I think it slows things down, and we've had some computers crash because of corrupted encryption information, like a FAT table. My question is, why not use Windows built-in enterprise-ready EFS? Do you know why? Have you tried it?
Well, it's interesting. This follows on some work I've recently done, which I will be sharing with all of our users before long. I found an incredibly nice free whole system encryption solution that does pre-boot encryption, where it alters the boot sector and points to some fixed file locations on the drive, and essentially does on-the-fly encryption decryption for a system that doesn't have an encrypted hard drive, and works beautifully with Windows. The reason I explored using EFS, this was for a specific application I was configuring about a month ago. The problem with EFS is when you pull a file out, it stays encrypted. And what you want is you want the hard drive to be encrypted, but not exports from the hard drive. And so specifically, I wanted the system to be safe, but if I copied a file, for example, to a USB, I wanted it decrypted in the process and to be transparent. Whereas EFS actually uses file attributes, tags this as encrypted, and you get an encrypted copy that you can't use. And I mean, which may be what you want, is to keep exported files from being decrypted on the fly, but that wasn't, in my case, the application I was looking for. So this thing I found, rather than teasing our users, I'll let everyone know, it's called Free CompuSec, FreeCompuSec. I've researched it extensively, and we'll be doing a show on it before long. But if anyone wants to go poke around at it, that's the name of it. And I have checked out the security of this thing, and it is they really got it nailed. It is nice. And I even went I've even benchmarked it because I wanted to find out what would be the overhead associated with doing software on the fly encryption decryption of the whole drive, which is what this thing does. Literally the entire physical hard drive, no matter how many partitions you divide it up into, no matter what you do, it starts at sector zero and runs an encryption across the entire drive when you put it into that state. And I don't have the numbers in front of me because I've got them written down for the show, but it was like 9% overhead. I mean, nothing. It was not, you couldn't feel the difference at all. It took maybe 326 minutes to do, or no, not 326 minutes. What I did was I benchmarked the defragmentation of a highly fragmented drive, both with and without this. And the increase was surprisingly minimal to add this on-the-fly encryption-decryption. So we'll be talking about that soon.
Wow, neat. Wow, very interesting. I can't wait. Our listener, Glenn in Denver, Colorado, is in a hurry to log in regarding Windows Steady State. He says, my biggest interest, in addition to customizing what's retained and what is preserved, is how long the restoration process takes. And we mentioned it does take a while. I always hate long login times required by machines that start up so many processes at login time. So this is the question of greatest concern. Is the logon process a matter of seconds, more on the order of minutes? How long?
Yeah, in my experience, and I didn't explore whether this is a function of the size of the cache. As I did mention in our steady state podcast, when you are going to install steady state, Windows asks you to defrag the drive to bring as much unused space into one large contiguous block. Then steady state, and I don't quite get why, but it just takes half of that. It's like, thank you very much. You had 50 gig free, now you've got 25.
Yeah.
And it's like, whoa!
That's now, annoying right there, I got to tell you.
Well, you can easily, there's a nice UI, you can easily bring that down to 1 gig or something, you know, substantially more reasonable. I don't know whether that speeds up the login process. The reason I didn't research it extensively is it wasn't that bad. I mean, the process definitely took longer. But it was more than seconds, but it was less than minutes. So maybe 45 seconds. Literally about 45 seconds. I mean, enough so that I'm the same way. I'm Mr. Login speed freak, and I was already saying that I don't run processes I don't need, and so forth. So when this thing kind of like came to a grinding halt, and I'm looking at a blank screen with a cursor, it's like, okay,
yeah.
Hello,
yeah.
But maybe it was 30 seconds. I mean, it was enough so that I knew it, but it wasn't enough so that I'm not going to use it in the application where steady state is really what I needed.
Yeah. Okay. But not, now he's talking about boot time. Does that relate to boot time?
Well, yeah, because when you log on, there's a like
it has to load in that partition.
No, I don't know what it's doing. I mean. It's definitely doing something. I thought maybe some other services were hung, so I went in and
so
I disabled.
Slow. I mean, it's slow.
It does slow down your login. There's no doubt about it. It slows down your login.
On the order of minutes?
No, like maybe 30 seconds.
Okay, that's not bad.
Yeah. Right. Again, it's like, Glenn is really concerned about that. So I wanted to say yes. And I wanted to also mention that people can try this. I mean, it does install nicely, and it goes away nicely too. So it's not a big problem to give this a shot and see how you feel about it, because
that's
it's
nice.
Easy to back yourself out of it.
You can back out. Okay.
Yep.
Now, you were very patient, so you can hear Mark Livingston's quick tip of the week. This is the award winner. Steve, he says, if people want to data mine the SecurityNow transcripts, Google can help. Are you ready? This is a really useful Google tip. I use this all the time. You type site colon, and then you can narrow it search down to a site. So in this case, If you type site:grc.com and then the word transcript, which will narrow it down to transcripts, and then whatever keywords you want, boom.
And I got to tell you, it works because this is I used it earlier today when I was putting the questions together for this AXCRYPT, A-X-C-R-Y-P-T.
Just to see if you'd ever mentioned the other one.
Yes, and nothing came up. And then I thought, is this working? So I was like, wait a minute.
No.
Maybe I'm fooling myself. So I put in, I don't know, VPN and went boom.
Yeah.
And there was like, it's perfect, Leo. It's like every one of our podcasts where I've mentioned VPN, thanks to Elaine transcribing them all, it's just bang. And thanks to Google, you can see the use of the VPN in context.
That's
And, you know, I have to say that I'm really pleased about this because I did mention last week or the week before that I was soon going to be adding full text search to GRC.
Now, you don't have to.
Change of plans. I've decided that I just can't screw around with GRC when I've got CryptoLink that I'm so excited to get to. You know, you and I talked about it 6 months ago, and I've made very little headway on it. So I decided, okay, we'll use this tip, site:grc.com/transcript/, and then whatever keywords, you search Google, instantly people can find things in the podcast, and that way I don't have to go spend another 6 months implementing my own native search. Instead, I can get to work on CryptoLink that I think a lot of our listeners will care more about anyway. So
yay.
That's the plan.
That's excellent. Well, I have to say, once Google finds its way into your page, they do a great job. I use Google for searching my sites. Why do your own search? You know, and I use WordPress and Drupal, and of course they have excellent searches. But Google does such a good job.
Yep,
I just use Google for it. Done is right. And many people, one of the things people complain about with podcasts, with netcasts, is their audio or video. How do you find stuff? You're so smart to have the transcripts. I think I really should do that for all the shows, because then it makes a netcast Google searchable.
Right.
I think it's a really, really good thing.
Okay, now read this number 12 carefully and slowly, Leo, because
okay.
This is extremely cool. I think it is the Amazing Idea of the Week award, but our listeners are going to have to pay attention to get this.
All right. Mike's Corporation in Minneapolis wins the Amazing Idea of the Week award. I just thought I'd write in to tell you about the enterprise security solution we use. I figured it was too esoteric to mention before, but since you brought up the use of VMware and Peter's response a couple episodes ago, I thought I'd share. In fact, our solution is just an inverted version of Peter's solution. What was Peter's solution?
Peter's was they had everybody running in VMware. Remember, he was the developer, and his company of developers were using VMware because they didn't want to have to constantly put Windows security patches in, which tended to break their build, their development build environment. And so the idea was they would keep the external Windows patched up and current, but then they would use a virtual machine image. Mm-hmm. And when they added somebody new to the project, they just give him an image and he's instantly ready to go.
Perfect. Perfect. Okay, well, he does the opposite. Sort of, upside down. Here's what he suggests. We want a virtual machine on each desktop. But instead of running the applications in the virtual machine and managing network security on the native machine as Peter does, we do the reverse. We abdicate control of the real machine's network card to the virtual machine so that the native Windows system doesn't use it and can't see it. We then establish a virtual network connection between the native Windows system and the virtual machine so that all the Windows network traffic is routed through the virtual machine. Inside the virtual machine, we run OpenBSD, which is a security-hardened version of BSD Unix. So this effectively puts every Windows system on the network behind its own Unix firewall. This is actually brilliant.
It is so cool.
I have some questions for you about implementation, but I get the idea. This way, even if a rogue system were to be plugged directly into our network, this is the advantage of doing it individually on each machine, there's a firewall between it and every other peer on the same Ethernet segment, an OpenBSD firewall. The main advantage with this inverted approach is that graphic-intensive apps running on the native Windows system have no performance penalty, except for, the RAM that's used by the virtual machine, but otherwise they have full use of the
machine. But that's where the beauty of OpenBSD comes in. He's about to talk about that.
We've also found some additional advantages using OpenBSD in the virtual machine instead of Windows. First of all, no additional Windows licenses are required because it's free. It's open source. And here, listen to this. The OpenBSD system can run in a virtual machine with a relatively small CPU and memory footprint, less than 32 megs. Of course, that's, you know, it's funny. I mean, that would be a lot a few years ago, but there's nothing on a 2-gig or 3-gig machine. The network packet filtering is much more configurable than what's provided in stock Windows, and I'll vouch for that. BSD has a great firewall. The network admins find that bulk configuration updates are much easier for Unix-based systems than for Windows-based systems. The system can be completely locked down by the admins without any fuss. Not even the most advanced Windows power users complain they're not allowed to reconfigure the OpenBSD. Of course not. They don't want to get in there.
Yeah.
This is clever. Now, but I have some implementation questions.
So essentially, just to clarify, it's exactly like a personal firewall, but you're using OpenBSD running on a Windows machine as your personal firewall.
It's almost like you have a UTM for every desk.
Yeah.
Its own UTM because, however you're configuring that security. Now, here's my question. Okay, so I'm running Windows natively. I'm running all my apps natively. How do I tell my desktop Windows to go through the virtual machine for its network access?
I have no idea.
I mean, I like that idea, but that's what you need to do, right? You have to tell the Windows system, oh, no, your network isn't coming from your hardware Ethernet card. It's coming from the virtual machine.
Exactly. Somehow you got to get the VM to publish a virtual network interface so that's what the hosting Windows system can see. I have no idea how you do that. I mean, I don't know that you couldn't. I just never tried it before.
Yeah, because normally when you use a VM, you're bridging your network access through Windows.
Correct.
The Windows, which has hardware access to the Ethernet, the NIC, has a network access, and it bridges it over to the virtual machine.
Right. He did mention in the original email, and I think looks like I maybe have cut that off, where he said he would tell us how to do it if I want. That's right. He said he would tell anyone who wanted to know how to do it. And I thought, well, that's not going to work well in a question. But I think I need to write back to him and say, okay, give. How exactly do you do this?
Well, I think this would be a good topic for a show. Is just let's talk about how to do this.
In detail, yes.
Yeah.
I mean, and what I love, again, is like, you know, there are some personal firewalls that are 32 megs. I mean, take up a huge amount of RAM. And the beauty of Unix is that it is so small. I mean, it's running in people's routers.
And this is, I mean, the hardened Unix distributions are widely distributed. I mean, I think OpenBSD is an extremely good choice, not only because, you know, it's hardened and it's secure, but also it's less likely to be known by many Windows or based hackers or even Linux based hackers. It's something a little different. But the other thing that worries me a little bit is you still have this hardware NIC and Windows, and they're sitting there right next to each other. You've really got to find a way to keep Windows from looking at that NIC.
I would think, I don't know what they're doing, but you can certainly unbind network interface cards from Windows. I mean, there's still this notion of binding of protocols and hardware.
So maybe you can bind it directly to the virtual machine.
Exactly, and you don't bind it to Windows,
right.
So Windows just doesn't see it at all.
Right.
And then if the VM is able to publish a virtual adapter, then that's what you bind the Windows networking protocols to. Anyway, I think this was so cool, very clever. We're going to find out how to do it. And I agree, Leo. The other thing, too, is that this could potentially, since now virtual machines are, I mean, not only are the virtual machine containers themselves free, especially if they've got OpenBSD in them, but we know, for example, that, you know, Windows virtual machine server is free. So this is potentially a 100% free solution.
Yeah, or VMware. You could use a VMware player and the VMware appliance.
Exactly.
Yeah. I wonder what. Well, that's the other thing. I'd like to know what he's using.
We're going to find out.
Is it VMware? Is it Windows, Microsoft's virtual machine. What did they still call it virtual PC? What do they call it? I can't remember.
Virtual PC. Last time
Well, I'm looking at VMware's virtual appliance marketplace, and they do have OpenBSDs. In fact, if you go there, you can look at their. They have a lot of free appliances, including a whole category of security appliances. So, I mean, there's a ton of choices there, including, Astaro, OpenBSD with VMware tools, NetBSD, Stockade. I mean, there's a ton of commercial, and these are all free, Smoothwall.
It may well be that this evolved from someone using one of those and saying, hey, wait a minute, why can't we
go the other
unbind
way.
Windows from the physical container, I mean, from the physical interface and bind it to a virtual interface?
Yeah. I wonder if anybody else has thought of this. Very clever idea.
Yeah, I love it.
Yeah. Okay, yes, you do. You win, Mike. I don't know who Mike's corporation in Minneapolis is, but...
No, he didn't say.
He probably doesn't want anybody to know.
But I'm going to track him down.
Wow. Really great. Hey, this is a long episode, but I think a really good one. We thank our new sponsors, Audible.com, and we welcome back our old sponsors, Astaro.com. Both great to have you both on. And some great questioners. Thank you all for your questions. If you'd like to ask Steve questions, you can do it right on his site, grc.com/feedback. Feedback. I never can remember that. Of course, GRC is a place to go for SpinRite, S-P-I-N-R-I-T-E, Steve's bread and butter, his day job, that great hard drive maintenance and recovery utility that everybody ought to have. You got a hard drive, you ought to have SpinRite. You must know that by now. You can also go there to get the 16 kilobit versions of this show. So for people who don't want to download a giant show or want to store it in somewhere, compactly with 130 shows, it does add up. You can get that from grc.com/security now, and also Lane's transcripts. And don't forget that search tool, because that's cool. You can just make that a search link that would automatically do that on your site.
Yeah, that would take 5 weeks.
Just pretend you wrote it.
Because it'd have to be perfect.
Pretend you wrote it and I think you could do that pretty easily. But anyway, all right. We'll let people do that. That's an assignment for home. Your homework assignment. Hey, Steve, thank you for a wonderful episode, and we'll talk to you next week on Security Now.
Talk to you then, Leo. Thanks.
Security Now.